Indians who grew up watching the character. Many say they were taunted in the schoolyard by being called Apu. That's not racism. That's just saying kids are dicks. Still, there have been enough complaints to fill a nasty little documentary called The Problem with Apu. And it has been a problem for us at The Simpsons. Hank Azaria, who takes most of the heat for the character, is reluctant to play Apu anymore. Sure, Hank is not Indian, but almost no one on our show plays what they are. White guys play black men, straights play gays, and grown women play little boys. And Apu might be an unflattering stereotype, but that can be said about lots of our characters, from Grandpa to Rich Texan. Groundskeeper Willie is pure cliché, a whiskey-swilling, haggis-eating, bagpipe-playing Scotsman, played by an Italian actor. And yet, as I mentioned before, the Scottish people love him. Maybe it's because he's the only Scotsman on television. We'd hate to lose a beloved character from the show, but times change, and maybe after 3 decades, time has run out for Apu. It's not my call. As a white Jewish guy, I can't tell Indians not to be offended by another white Jewish guy playing an Indian. Making the big dough. The Simpsons has many famous catchphrases, but only one is truly original. We took Bart's cowabunga from Chief Thunder Thud on the Howdy Doody show. Eat my shorts is the line Nancy Cartwright improvised, remembering it from her high school band days. The caramba in I Caramba was a Portuguese flamenco dancer. Don't have a cow dates back to the 50s. It's a variant on the British phrase, don't have kittens. Our most famous catchphrase is Homer's, "Doh!" But even that's not original. It came from 30s film comedian Jimmy Finlayson, and he said it as a euphemism for damn. "Doh" is so popular it made it into the Oxford English Dictionary, though it's misspelled as "doh," D-O-H. You can't even trust the Oxford English Dictionary. We actually write it in scripts as, quotes, "annoyed grunt." Dan Castellaneta saw that stage direction and read it as "doh." Sometimes we write intentionally challenging stage directions like, quote, "confused annoyed grunt that suddenly turns amorous." Whatever we throw at him, Dan can do it. What's the one original catchphrase on The Simpsons? Nelson Muntz's "ha ha." It first appeared in a John Swartzwelder script, The War of the Simpsons. Grandpa, threatening to whip Nelson, takes off his belt, and Grandpa's pants fall down. Nelson says for the first time, "ha ha." There are a million ways to read that word, but the way Nancy Cartwright did it was as a two-note bray, E-sharp, C-sharp. That first, "ha ha," produced an explosion of laughter at the table read, and a classic was born. True fact. There is a guy living in Macon, Georgia, whose name is Homer Simpson, and he works in a nuclear power plant. That poor guy, having to live in Macon, Georgia. Chapter 7, Meet the Cast. One day while recording the show, Dan Castellaneta, Homer, and Nancy Cartwright, Bart, were horsing around when Julie Kavner, she's Marge, told them to cut it out. Meanwhile, Yardley Smith, that's Lisa, moaned that we'd never get the work done in time. Sam Simon leaned over to me and whispered, "They're just like their characters." There's definitely some truth to that, but they're a pretty diverse group, and they all got their jobs in different ways. Dan Castellaneta and Julie Kavner were cast members on The Tracy Ullman Show. When The Simpsons shorts became part of that series in the second season, Dan was given the role of Homer. Tracy Ullman herself was going to play Marge, but the show kept her too busy. Julie got the role instead. Nancy Cartwright, already an accomplished voice actress in 1986, auditioned for the role of Lisa and wound up as Bart. Yardley Smith, who'd never done voiceover, came in for Bart and wound up as Lisa. We now had the Simpsons family, but when the cartoon shorts expanded to a half-hour series, we needed additional actors to fill out the rest of Springfield. Matt Groening suggested Harry Shearer. Matt was a fan of his NPR series, Les Show, in which Harry played multiple roles week after week. Harry's our most experienced actor. He started out as a child star working with Jack Benny and Abbott and Costello. Check out Abbott and Costello Go to Mars. A young Harry appears in the first 10 minutes. He's instantly recognizable and hilarious. Hank Azaria was the last of our main cast members to join The Simpsons. We had already recorded our first episode when we brought him in as a replacement Moe. Christopher Collins originated the character, but the producers wanted a different voice. Hank's previous voice acting experience consisted of exactly one job, the title role of Hollywood Dog in a failed Fox pilot. Hank was brought back episode by episode during The Simpsons' first season. He joined the cast full-time in our second year. Since he's been a regular for only 29 of our 30 seasons, Matt Groening calls Hank the new guy. Let's learn more about the cast. Dan Castellaneta, he plays Homer, Barney, Grandpa, and Krusty. Except for male pattern baldness, Dan has absolutely nothing in common with Homer. Dan is modest, soft-spoken, even-tempered, and deeply intelligent. He plays dozens of characters on the show, but stumbles only when reading Homer's lines. It's like he's channeling his inner dyslexic. Of the three men in our cast, he's the only Gentile, so obviously we made him voice Krusty, our main Jewish character. Julie Kavner plays Marge, Patty, and Selma. Julie naturally found Marge's raspy voice after a grueling week of rehearsals on the Tracy Ullman show. When she's asked why Marge loves Homer despite all his faults, and she's asked that a lot, she replies, "He's good in bed." I don't think she's kidding. Early in the show, Julie asked Jim Brooks how she should differentiate the voices of Patty and Selma. Jim replied, "Don't." Nancy Cartwright, she plays Bart, Nelson, and Ralph. Not since Lassie had a TV actor played a classic character of the opposite sex. Nancy Cartwright has three of them. In Nelson, Bart, and Ralph, she embodies the id, the ego, and the superego of American boyhood. There is some high-class academic bullshit for you. Nancy is so bouncy and vivacious that it seems natural when Bart's voice comes out of her. Except for a couple of times when she was 8 months pregnant. She'd say, "Don't have a cow, man," and she looked like she was literally going to have a cow. Now she's a grandmother. Yardley Smith, the voice of Lisa. Dan may do 30 characters on the show, and Harry may do 50, but Yardley does one. But what a character! For many of us, Lisa is the heart and soul of the show, the source of its emotional depth. She shares enough of Lisa's anxieties and insecurities to fill a one-woman show. Her funny, touching, and occasionally harrowing stage presentation called More. Hank Azaria. He plays Mo, Apu, Chief Wiggum, and comic book guy. Hank has an amazing gift for creating memorable characters from small parts, which is why many of them don't even have names. Comic book guy, Bumblebee man, old Jewish man, sea captain, wise guy. He claims some of them are just really bad impersonations of famous acting icons, including Mo, that's supposed to be Al Pacino, Dr. Nick Riviera, that's supposed to be Desi Arnaz, and Lou the Cop, you won't believe it, is supposed to be Sylvester Stallone. Hank has a special link to Chief Wiggum. When Hank has to learn a song for a role, he sings it in Wiggum's voice first. Says Hank, "I have more faith in Wiggum's voice than my own." You haven't heard Let It Go from Frozen till you've heard Hank sing it as Chief Wiggum. A million people have already viewed it on YouTube. Harry Shearer. He plays Mr. Burns, Smithers, Ned Flanders, Dr. Hibbert, and Kent Brockman. Harry is enormously proud that he plays both the nicest guy in Springfield, Ned Flanders, and the meanest one, Mr. Burns. as well as providing the voices of both God and Satan. That's range. Those long dialogue scenes between Burns and Smithers are just Harry talking to himself, effortlessly switching between characters, and in 30 years I've never seen him make a mistake once. In 2016, Harry thought about leaving the show. Senator Ted Cruz, in the middle of his presidential run, auditioned for his roles. You can see that on YouTube, too. Ted Cruz auditions for The Simpsons. Needless to say, that's two jobs Ted Cruz didn't get that year. Special mention, Phil Hartman. Phil Hartman would roll into The Simpsons recordings with the easygoing charm of a door-to-door salesman. He could be both sincere and a parody of sincerity at the same time. As Conan O'Brien pointed out, there's no difference between Phil Hartman and a Phil Hartman robot. Phil brought this android-like quality to his performances. He'd make the long drive from Malibu to Fox and record his lines perfectly on the first take. I couldn't bear the thought that he'd driven 90 minutes to do 5 minutes' work. I'd always make him do extra takes just to make it worth his while. I wouldn't see that level of perfection again until 2 decades later, when Stephen Colbert guested on the show. He played a very Phil Hartman-esque life coach, and he nailed every line immediately. Phil contributed 2 indelible characters to The Simpsons, sleazy lawyer Lionel Hutz and washed-up actor Troy McClure. They had exactly the same voice. This was never a problem until the time we wrote a scene featuring both Lionel and Troy. Phil tried gamely to differentiate these 2 characters, but I told him not to bother. Phil was murdered the week Futurama recorded its pilot, in which he was supposed to voice arrogantly stupid space hero Zap Brannigan. Instead, the character's played by Billy West doing his best version of Phil Hartman. But there's no replacing Phil. We didn't even try. After he died, we retired Lionel Hutz and Troy McClure forever. Bonus voice actor factoid. Pamela Hayden. She's cute, sexy, flirtatious, and she's Milhouse. It's a little disturbing. The Case of the Vanishing Julie. The cast of The Simpsons appeared on Inside the Actor's Studio in 2003. It was a great show and a remarkable coup getting them all in one place. While half of them live in Los Angeles, Hank Azaria is in New York, Harry Shearer's in New Orleans, and Julie Kavner spends much of the year in Michigan. On top of that, both Julie and Dan Castellaneta don't like to be filmed doing their characters. They feel it robs Homer and Marge of their realism. Paul Fusco felt the same way. During the entire run of Alf, he never let it be known he was the voice and puppeteer of the alien. Bravo Network was so proud of this Actor Studio episode that they seemed to air it day and night for the next decade. It was on so often that even casual viewers noticed a weird detail. Julie Kavner vanishes in the middle of the show. She's there, and suddenly she's gone, and none of the actors comment on it. Many fans have asked me what happened. The night of the taping, Julie told the Bravo producers that she had to catch a plane in 3 hours. They told her that shouldn't be a problem. The show runs just over an hour. What they didn't say is that they taped for 4 hours and then cut it down to the best 65 minutes. One cast member told me that when James Lipton brought out his prepared questions, they were on a stack of index cards 6 inches thick. Julie stayed for as long as she could, but when her time ran out, so did she. It's a disappearing act worthy of Houdini. Nancy Cartwright on voice direction. I'd been working professionally for years before The Simpsons, doing My Little Pony, Pound Puppies, Snorks, Richie Rich. That was Saturday morning syndicated television. There was just a certain way of doing it. So I was kind of shocked that The Simpsons writers were directing us, and it was taking all day. We were there from 10 in the morning till about 9 o'clock at night. That was just not done. It was an extraordinary amount of time. And yet I'm so glad I kept my big mouth shut, because what ended up evolving from that particular procedure was genius. At the same time, any suggestion that I would have, or any ad-libs I did, the writers appreciated, Because we were a team. We were absolutely a collaborative team. Now, meet the guest stars. If you believe Wikipedia, The Simpsons had 725 guest stars in its first 26 seasons. Of course, according to Wikipedia, I've had sex with 725 supermodels. I know because I put it there. Guest stars have been a part of the show since the pilot, when Penny Marshall played the babysitter bandit. In that same episode, William Shatner became the first celebrity to turn down a guest shot on The Simpsons when we offered him a role parodying himself, if that's possible. Our guest stars have come from the world of acting, like Glenn Close, music, three of the Beatles, John won't return our calls, science, we had Stephen Hawking, literature, we got J.K. Rowling, comedy, Joan Rivers, and tragedy, John Lovitz. There were even serious actors who were really funny, like MacGyver's Richard Dean Anderson. Best of all, there were guests who acted exactly like themselves in person. For example, Larry King spent 20 minutes talking to me about bagels. Thomas Pynchon, an author who hasn't been photographed or interviewed in half a century, appeared on The Simpsons. Twice! The first time he played against his image, yelling at passersby, "Hey, over here! Have your picture taken with a reclusive author!" The second time he appeared, he even wrote jokes for himself. After landing Pynchon and getting the equally mysterious artist Banksy to animate our couch gag, we offered a part to the granddaddy of all recluses, J.D. Salinger. We approached him through his son, actor Matt Salinger, played a jock in Revenge of the Nerds. J.D. Salinger gave us the quickest rejection we ever got, 45 seconds. Johnny Carson went from being omnipresent to reclusive. After he left The Tonight Show, he made only two TV appearances, on the American Teachers Awards presentation and Us. We'd heard from a friend who was working for him that Carson said, "Gee, they get all these big celebrities on The Simpsons. Why don't they ask me?" So we did. We wrote a storyline where a post-retirement Carson comes to visit The Simpsons and won't leave. He becomes the bad brother-in-law, sleeping on their couch, stealing the last piece of pizza, drinking Homer's beer. Carson was deeply offended and turned down the part. The writing staff was ready to give up on him, but I urged them to try another approach. Instead of making Johnny a slob, let's make him a superhero. We wrote a scene where he appeared on the Krusty the Clown show, singing opera and juggling a Chrysler with one hand. Carson accepted. He rolled into our studio early one morning, did a little monologue for us about the previous night's Emmys. Johnny had won one but didn't show up. He recorded his lines, charmed everyone, and signed autographs for the next 2 hours. There was a funny piece of dialogue from the episode that got cut. After Johnny juggles the car, Krusty says to him, "Wow, Johnny, how come you never did this on your show?" And Carson replies, "Suzanne Plachette ran long." Other Tonight Show hosts, Leno, Conan, all the way back to Steve Allen, also did our show. Steve, though clearly a brilliant man, needed 9 takes to do the line, "Ay, caramba." We finally used the "I" from take 6 and the "caramba" from take 3. Dustin Hoffman appeared in the episode Lisa's Substitute, playing Lisa's Substitute. His character, Mr. Bergstrom, was based on a teacher I had by the same name. My Mr. Bergstrom had a deformed hand, so I asked the animators to give the character some sort of humanizing deformity. The deformity they gave him, they made him look exactly like me. Sam Simon designed the character, modeling Bergstrom's Semitic good looks, which means bad looks, on mine. Hoffman asked that we not use his name in the credits, so we called him Sam Edick, a terrible pun on Semitic. To recap, Mr. Bergstrom had Dustin Hoffman's voice and my face, but Sam Edick gets all the credit. Here's a trivia question. If Mr. Bergstrom was played by a 2-time Oscar winner, what character was voiced by a 4-time Oscar winner? Maggie Simpson. She rarely speaks, but when she does, she's voiced by a guest star, Elizabeth Taylor, Jodie Foster, and Carol Kane. The actresses playing Maggie have won 4 Oscars and been nominated 10 times. Liz Taylor played Maggie back in 1992, uttering the baby's first word. Liz created the biggest stir of any guest star we've had on the show. 300 people packed our tiny studio to hear her record her one-word part. Daddy. She had to do 6 takes because, as you might imagine, it kept coming out too sexy. We had to remind her she was a baby talking to her father, not hitting on him. Liz did hit on one guy in the crowded room, our animation supervisor, David Silverman. "Who's that?" she purred. Silverman was the handsomest guy in the room, but then, compared to the Simpsons writers, Paul Giamatti would also have won that prize. All of this raises a pertinent question. Why do we even use guest stars? After all, our cast can imitate anyone on Earth. In fact, we once wrote a whole show for Woody Allen, but Dan Castellaneta did such a spot-on impression at rehearsals, we decided, who needs Woody? Truth is, we often write in guest stars just to meet our idols. The writers have used the show to bring in all their comedy heroes. Eric Idle, Rodney Dangerfield, Albert Brooks, Mel Brooks, Jerry and Richard Lewis. Ricky Gervais, who sort of invented modern comedy with the original version of The Office, asked us if he could write an episode. We were flattered, and even more flattered when he called back 2 weeks later and said, "I can't do it, it's too hard." He did pitch the plot of the show, star in it, and perform original songs. We were all fans of the show Girls, so Lena Dunham was a natural choice. But it hadn't occurred to us until I sat behind her on a plane and heard her talking. Her voice was perfect for animation. We also cast German director Werner Herzog, not your typical guest star, after hearing his one-of-a-kind voice on a documentary. We get a guest star when it's appropriate. If we do an opera show, we get Placido Domingo. A tennis show, Pete Sampras. We had 9 Major League Baseball players on our softball show, and every single famous magician alive on our magic episode. We even got Teller, the silent half of Penn and, to talk. Sometimes it's not so appropriate. Like the episode where Homer goes into space, our guest stars were Buzz Aldrin and James Taylor. What can I say? We wanted to meet James Taylor. Then there's time we asked George Takei from Star Trek to play himself in our monorail episode. Takei had been on an earlier episode playing a sushi chef, and he loved it. But Takei turned us down, saying, "I don't make fun of monorails." Turns out he's an impassioned fan of public transit. Instead, we went to Leonard Nimoy, who happily took the part. How often do you ask for Sulu and wind up with Spock? It can get weirder than that. We once wrote a part for a random celebrity. We asked our casting agent for suggestions, and she said, "Blank owes Fox $400, and that's what we pay our guest stars. He can come in and work off the debt." I don't know what this legendary performer did to run up this tab. Steal a computer? Whatever it was, he made for a fun, surprising choice for the role. Except for that guy, no celebrity does The Simpsons for the money. So why do they do it? First off, it's easy. Even a leading guest star role doesn't take more than an hour to record, and there's no wardrobe or makeup to worry about. Plus, the celebrity can come in at his or her convenience any time during a 2-month window. Or not come in at all. We've recorded guest stars in their homes, in their cars, and over the phone. But there are other reasons. One reason is they like the show. The reason we had so few older guest stars on the early episodes is because senior citizens never watched our show. For one episode, we offered the role of God to Burt Lancaster, Charlton Heston, and Gregory Peck, who all said no. Years later, Kirk Douglas appeared on our show as a con man. He had a stroke shortly after, making this Simpsons role his last lusty, full-throated Kirk Douglas performance. Another reason celebrities do the show, their kids make them do it. Or sometimes their grandkids make them do it. This was the case with George Harrison, and it made us all feel very old. Sometimes they do the show because they're friends of the producers. Jim Brooks has brought in as guest stars half the cast of his old series, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Cloris Leachman, Ed Asner, Betty White, and Valerie Harper. Jay Kogan delivered his friends Phil Hartman and John Lovitz from the comedy troupe The Groundlings. Sam Simon drew on his days at Cheers to cast Kelsey Grammer as Sideshow Bob. Kelsey is every bit as smart as the characters he plays. We've never written a Sideshow Bob line so esoteric that he didn't get it. And although he's not as evil as Bob, Kelsey is a staunch Republican. And like Sideshow Bob, he did a little jail time in the 80s. I was directing him in a scene where Bob is being shoved into a prison cell, and I said, "I need you to make a noise like you're being roughed up by cops." And he said with a grin, "Oh, I can do that." The Quarter Century Audition, William Friedkin. Back in 1992, we were writing our Mr. Plow episode when we heard a rumor that Oscar-winning director William Friedkin, he made The French Connection and The Exorcist, William Friedkin was a huge fan of the show. "Let's write a joke for him," we decided. This was the only time we ever did a gag for a single viewer. We threw in a shot of Homer Snowplow driving on a rickety rope bridge right out of Friedkin's film Sorcerer. A quarter century later, I finally met the guy and told him about our joke. Friedkin had seen it, and he loved it. I invited him to our next Simpsons table read, and he showed up with a guest, the Bishop of Los Angeles. Mr. Friedkin proceeded to charm everyone in the place and created a sensation like I hadn't seen since Liz Taylor's visit. We immediately wrote him a guest role in our 2017 Treehouse of Horror. He finally got a spot on our show, and it only took him 25 years. My favorite guest star. We had heavyweight champ Joe Frazier on the show in 1992. We sent George Meyer, the writing staff's biggest boxing fan, to record him. I wasn't even at the session, but I listened to the tape of it over and over. Joe's line was, "We now present the Montgomery Burns Award for Outstanding Achievement in the Field of Excellence." We should have realized that Frazier had never uttered a sentence that long in his life. He had whole press conferences that were shorter than this line. It was an ungainly sentence that Olivier might have had trouble with. Joe immediately was struggling with the line, so George Meyer decided to break it into smaller bits. So Frazier says, "We now present the..." "Cut! Perfect! Keep going, champ!" "Montgomery!" "Fantastic! You're a natural!" Frazier fought his way through the line, one phrase at a time. Punch for punch, jab for jab, he was nailing it. It all went beautifully until the final word, excellence. Frazier asked, "Is that excellent or ex-a-lunch?" He didn't know the term excellence, but he seemed to think ex-a-lunch was a word. George tried to explain to him, "It's excellence, lens, like a contact lens." Then there was a long, baffled silence from Joe Frazier. And George said, "Look, we can change this to another word." And Frazier said, "No, I can do this." Listening to his determination is truly what made Joe Frazier my favorite guest star. I saw what made him a champ. He never gave up, whether he was fighting with Muhammad Ali or wrestling with a three-syllable word. He was going to get this line right if it took him 20 takes. And he did finally get it right. And it did take 20 takes. Guest star memories, David Copperfield. Obviously, I did the magic episode. It was really, really fun. And the best thing in the world is to be asked back. When the audience comes back to see you a second time, that's a good thing. I got to do it a second time, reprising my role as me, and I just love doing this show with these really smart, smart people doing crazy stuff. It's very rewarding. Michael Jackson, super guest star. In 1991, Michael Jackson called Matt Groening and said he wanted to do The Simpsons. Michael was at the peak of his super-duper stardom at the time, as big as the Beatles in the days of Beatlemania, and no performer I can recall has since been quite so huge. The whole staff was tasked with coming up with ideas for an episode, and Jim Brooks had the best. Homer is put in a mental institution, where his cellmate is a 300-pound white guy who thinks he's Michael Jackson, with Michael doing the voice. Al Jean and I were assigned the script, and we started with an outline, a 20-page single-space story synopsis. It was a dry, nearly unreadable document, but Jackson read it and offered some funny suggestions. He pitched the scene where Bart tells the town that Michael Jackson is coming to visit, creating an uproar. And he added the scene where Michael, in quotes, writes a song with Bart. He also made us change a joke about Prince to be about Elvis. Al and I were showrunners at the time, so we wrote this script after hours, generally starting work at 11 p.m. It was a real grind, and neither of us thought Michael would actually do the show. We had the script reading at the home of Michael's manager, Sandy Gallen. It was a mansion so large, Gallen remarked, "You know, I still haven't seen every room in my house." I sat next to Michael at the reading and was 3 feet away from him as he sang Ben, Thriller, and the song he composed for the episode, Lisa, It's Your Birthday. I couldn't wait till we got that performance on tape. Michael came into our studios a few days later to record the show. He was alone, no entourage, and was strikingly handsome. This was about three nose jobs before the end. I was also surprised by how tall and strong he appeared. It was this sad realization that Michael Jackson could kick my ass. He was very friendly and shook everyone's hand. As we were about to start the recording, Sam Simon announced, "I'd like to have a big Simpsons round of applause for Michael." Jackson smiled humbly. "Reese, who just won $50 playing Phone Jeopardy." Michael Jackson looked baffled at first, then nicely joined in the applause. Jim Brooks stepped in to personally direct Michael, but Michael was no actor, and Jim is not the only Oscar-winning director to try and squeeze a good performance out of him. Martin Scorsese in the Bad music video and Francis Ford Coppola in Captain EO both tried in vain to make Michael look badass. If Michael's acting wasn't great, at least his singing would be. We'd recorded all of Michael's spoken parts in the morning, and we would finish the day with the songs. And that's when Michael called in a little white guy. "This is Kip Lennon. He's my authorized sound-alike." For all you old-timers, Kip is the brother of the singing group The Lennon Sisters. Michael stood by laughing as Kip performed all the songs in that episode. It's an amazing impression, but if you watch the show again, you can tell that Kip is actually spoofing Michael to Jackson's delight. We asked Jackson, "Michael, why are you doing this?" He replied cryptically, "It's a joke on my brothers." Let me be the first to say it. Michael Jackson was an odd guy. Guest Star Memories, John Lovitz. I thought the streetcar episode I was in was a really funny show. It was so funny, I still remember some of the lines. I played the director, Llewellyn Sinclair. "I have directed 3 plays in my career, and I have had 3 heart attacks. That's how much I care. I'm planning for a 4th. I remember the first time I was doing the read-through, and they would be dying laughing the moment I opened my mouth. I remember thinking, gee, they really think I'm funny. Guest stars we can't get. We've asked Bruce Springsteen to do the show repeatedly, but he always turns us down. We sent him a Simpsons jacket as a bribe, which didn't work. We even had his sax player, Clarence Clemens, on the show, hoping he'd tell Bruce how much fun it was. That didn't work either. Bruce, we'd like our jacket back. It's odd, because rock stars rarely turn us down. We've had so many on the show that when we wanted to open the Simpsons movie with a musical act, we said, "Who's left? We've had them all." I finally pushed for Green Day because I wanted free Green Day tickets. They did the movie and now get requests to do their version of the Simpsons theme at concerts. Or so I hear. I never got my free tickets. We've had the mayor of New York, Rudolph Giuliani, and the prime minister of the UK, Tony Blair. We had Giuliani delivering the commencement address at a school for police dogs. He told us, "You know, I've actually had to do this." As for Blair, he recorded his role at the same time he was deciding to enter the Iraq War. This is proof you shouldn't try to do 2 things at once. What we've never had is a U.S. president. Gerald Ford was our first ask. We were going to show him working in the Gerald Ford Presidential Library, stamping books and shaking down patrons for 15-cent late fees. But he turned us down. Every president from Ford to Obama rejected us. Michelle Obama turned us down, too. The closest we ever came was Bill Clinton. After we wrote him a part and sent him the script, he notified us, "While I'd love to do The Simpsons, I'd never do anything to disgrace the office of the president." Sometimes they write the jokes for you. And then there's a story I heard from Jimmy Carter's grandson himself. As a kid, the grandson was always urging Grandpa Jimmy to watch The Simpsons. "You'll like it. It's smart and satirical." One week, Jimmy Carter decided to watch our show. It was the episode where Springfield has budget cuts, so instead of getting a statue of Abraham Lincoln for the park, they get the much cheaper Jimmy Carter statue. When it's unveiled, a riot breaks out, with someone calling Jimmy Carter history's greatest monster. Needless to say, Jimmy Carter will never do our show. Tom Cruise was an early fan of the show. Tapes of new episodes were sent to him when he was filming on location. And so we wrote a role just for him. He was supposed to play Tom, the Top Gun pilot in the episode Brother from the Same Planet. Cruise turned down the part, so we gave the role to Phil Hartman in what became a classic episode. Tom turned us down, but did the movie The Mummy. Go figure. In Alec Guinness's memoir, A Positively Final Appearance, we learned that he was a big Simpsons fan. Unfortunately, we read this in 2001, and Guinness passed away the year before. Oh! Why didn't he tell us? The same thing happened with Stanley Kubrick. We didn't find out he was a fan till after he died. There are three celebrities who asked to be on The Simpsons, but after we wrote a part for them, turned it down. Prince, George Lucas, and Lyle Lovett. Okay, two celebrities and Lyle Lovett. Prince was eager to do the show until he saw the script we'd written for him. He was to reprise the role of Leon Kompowski, the 300-pound mental patient who thought he was Michael Jackson, was now back, and this time he thought he was Prince. The real Prince said no thanks, and the script was burned. George Lucas told a friend he wanted to do our show, so we wrote him a very funny part. Lucas would be hanging around with comic book guy, always talking about Star Wars, but not quite getting it right. We're like those two on the spaceship, the big dog and the guy in the vest. Lucas turned down the part, but we had our revenge. A few years later, we parodied the lousy Star Wars prequels. We called it Cosmic Wars, featuring Jim Jam Bonks. And we depicted the film's creators as a 3-foot-tall gnome who looked exactly like George Lucas. The parody was so vicious that the day after it aired, The Simpsons writer showed an emotion I'd never seen from them before. Remorse. Al Jean sighed, "We didn't have to make him that short." Guest star memories, Judd Apatow. Then they did an episode in which my wife, Leslie Mann, Paul Rudd, and I did voices. You don't get better career highs than that. I went into the studio to record it, and James Brooks pitched me incredible lines. I know that Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg were so thrilled to get an opportunity to write an episode that Seth guest starred on. Everyone says, "I can't believe I got to do it." Someday we'll look at that picture of us recording and say, "Remember that day we recorded The Simpsons?" That's always at the top of the list. It's an honor to be nominated, but a bitch to lose. The Simpsons has won 32 Emmys, more than any other sitcom except Frasier, which has 37. Each of our cast members has won at least one. Dan Castellaneta received 4 for playing Homer. Even our guest stars have won Emmys. Kelsey Grammer for Sideshow Bob, Jackie Mason as Rabbi Krestovsky, Marshall Wallace as Mrs. Krabappel, and Anne Hathaway as Krusty's sidekick, Princess Penelope. We've won 10 Emmys for Outstanding Animated Program, and even 2 for Outstanding Music and Lyrics. We put The Spring in Springfield, and You're Checking In. Both songs were composed by Simpsons writer Ken Keeler, and they're both Broadway showstoppers with unconventional topics. One's about a whorehouse, the other's about a drug rehab clinic. The Simpsons has won so many Emmys, it was parodied on the Simpsons Family Guy crossover. Peter Griffin picks a fight with Homer Simpson. Homer yanks open an enormous cabinet stuffed with Emmys, which he hurls at Peter one by one. Yet there are still people who think The Simpsons has never won an Emmy. That's because our awards aren't handed out at the boring televised ceremony. Our awards are handed out at the super boring untelevised ceremony, the Creative Arts Awards. This is a 4-hour awards show honoring achievements in lighting, sound design, picture editing, hairstyling, makeup, and animation. It's a ceremony so dull, one year I watched the host, a popular TV comedian, wrap up the show, storm off stage, and immediately call his agent to say, "I am never going to do that show again." In addition to Emmys, The Simpsons has won 30 Annie Awards for animation, 11 Writers Guild Awards for our scripts, and the first Peabody Award ever given to an animated show. We've even won 6 Genesis Awards, and I don't know what the hell they are. But we want more. Awards are addictive. Sam Simon once crafted an elaborate mystery plot for the episode Black Widower, hoping to win an Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America. He didn't get one, but I did in 2000 for my caveman detective story, Cro-Magnon P.I. The award is a painted plaster bust of Edgar Allan Poe. It looks like a novelty bottle that should be filled with bourbon, as the real Poe often was. I think we've even got a shot at the Nobel Prize in Literature. If Bob Dylan's folk songs can win, why not Matt Groening's internationally beloved cartoon? My college pal Saul Perlmutter won the Nobel Prize in Physics, and he said the Nobels are a 4-day party in Sweden. Sounds better than the Creative Arts Emmys. I love celebrities. I know there are rotten celebrities out there. There's the lovable family comic, not Tim Allen, whom my friend called the worst man on earth. And the sitcom star, still not Tim Allen, who was so mean he made an Air Force colonel cry. And the lovable family comic slash sitcom star, who did 2 years in prison for selling coke. I've heard that Bruce Willis is so monstrous, one of his directors, a cancer survivor, said, "I'd go through another round of chemo rather than work with Bruce again." I have no stories like this. All the celebrities I've worked with have 2 things in common. They're much smarter than you'd think, and they're incredibly nice. Take Rob Schneider. I was hired to help him make a dumb movie script even dumber. When I asked him to describe the lead character, he went into a 20-minute discourse on Jean-Jacques Rousseau's concept of the noble savage. Rob also cooked me French toast, something my mother never did. There's nothing weird about Weird Al Yankovic. He's a solid family man and incredibly sweet. And another thing you probably don't know is that he skipped 2 grades in high school and graduated as class valedictorian. And there's Tom Arnold. I assumed he was a dope and challenged him to a game of chess. He kicked my butt so bad while simultaneously making a phone call and eating a plate of ribs that I never played chess again. For years, I kept a typewritten fan letter on my office wall. It was the most cogent, articulate analysis of The Simpsons I'd ever read, so much so that I thought it belonged in a scholarly journal. The letter was signed, Joey Ramone, The Ramones. I worked with Jim Carrey on the animated film Horton Hears a Who. He was almost supernaturally kind. It was like writing gags for the Buddha. I witnessed one remarkable incident where he had to record the line, "What?" I wrote that. He rattled off 58 takes, all different, all funny. He told the recording engineer, "Play back take 17. The engineer played a take. Jim said, "That was take 18. He was right. The engineer then played back take 17, and it was the best of the bunch. It was amazing. David Copperfield called me out of the blue looking for a couple of jokes for his Vegas act. I don't even know how he got my number. Magic? I thought the whole thing was a prank. This must happen to him a lot because he said, after I hang up, go on YouTube and look at clips of me. You'll see it's the same voice. He not only became my friend, he's the greatest guy on earth. I mean, it's gotta be someone. He's funny, bright, charming, and generous. Of the 725 guest stars we've had on The Simpsons, I've heard complaints about only three. One actor, one author, one athlete. As for my personal experience, I've worked with only one celeb whom I considered a diva. I needed 10 minutes of her time, but she'd only give me 5. To protect her anonymity, the publisher's legal department will only let me give you her first name. Oprah. Burning question. Do you read what fans post on websites? Yes, and it kills us. We have a lot of very loyal fans who seem to hate the show. Their website is even called nohomers.net. This is like calling a Christian website jesussucks.gov. The website is the source of Comic Book Guy's catchphrase, worst blank ever. Every Sunday, minutes after The Simpsons aired, some fan would post the phrase, worst episode ever. After weeks of this, someone posted at 8:15 p.m., I'm halfway through tonight's show, but I can already tell it's the worst episode ever. Then, one Tuesday night, someone posted, I just saw the promo for next Sunday's Simpsons, and it clearly will be the worst episode ever. So why do these people keep watching the show? I stuck a fork in a light socket once and realized I should never do that again. These viewers keep sticking forks in the socket week after week, year after year. And every time, they're shocked that they're shocked. Worst pun ever. Most of us rarely have the stomach to read the fan site. But as a diligent showrunner, Al Jean studies it every single week. Al Jean, whom the fans have said should get cancer or die in a car crash. Why does he put himself through this? Because sometimes the fans get it right. They're especially sensitive when we write Homer too mean, a syndrome they call jerk-ass Homer. They say it and we listen. But sometimes they should cut us some slack. One fan complained, in season 8, Homer smuggled beer. Then in season 27, he smuggled snakes. Rip off. Yes, we did 2 vaguely similar stories 19 years apart. But the fan who complained was only 14 years old. We hadn't even repeated ourselves in his lifetime. Whatever the fans may say, people are still watching the show. Our ratings in season 29 were the highest they've been in years. To extrapolate from this, The Simpsons will run for 5 million years. But the fans will say it hasn't been funny since the 3 millionth season. Chapter 8. 4 episodes that change the world. Kind of. If you Google Simpsons Best Episode List, you'll get 20,100,000 hits. If you Google Simpsons Worst Episode List, you'll get 669,000 more. Yeesh. The point is, the world doesn't need another list of best episodes. Instead, I'd like to tell you the never-before-told stories behind 4 Simpsons episodes I worked on that broke new ground and changed the series forever. Seminal episode number 1, Like Father, Like Clown. Often it takes just one joke to clinch an idea. This was the case with Jake Hogan and Wally Wolodarski's episode, Like Father, Like Clown. It was a take on The Jazz Singer, with Krusty the Clown estranged from his Orthodox rabbi father. The problem was, we'd never even said Krusty was Jewish before. But then Al Jean pitched, his real name should be Krustovsky. It got a big laugh, particularly from Jim Brooks, and the idea was approved. The show established a number of precedents. Number 1, it was about a peripheral character. Bart and Lisa save the day here, but it's Krusty's story going all the way back to his childhood. Since then, we've explored almost every character's backstory, from Sideshow Mel's acting career to Carl's Icelandic roots. Like Father Like Clown was a big revelation. The Simpsons doesn't have to be about The Simpsons. Number two, other religions are funny too. This was only episode 41, but we'd already explored the family's religion, a Protestant sect called Presbyterianism. But this show explored Judaism in a big way. In years to come, we'd tackle Homer's conversion to Catholicism, Apu's Hindu faith, and Lisa's embrace of Buddhism. We've made fun of every religion except Islam. There's nothing funny about those guys. Don't hurt us. Number three, homework pays off. The episode ends with a Talmudic debate between Rabbi Krestovsky and Bart. To write this, we enlisted the help of three real rabbis as consultants. It remains the most scholarly debate you'll ever hear on the nature of comedy and Judaism in a cartoon on Fox. Jay and Wally wrote a terrific script. It was beautifully animated by Brad Bird. And Jackie Mason, a former rabbi himself, was unexpectedly moving as Rabbi Krestovsky. He won an Emmy for his role. We learned another lesson. If you want to make a touching TV show, rip off a touching movie. The Jazz Singer has been remade several times, starring, respectively, Al Jolson, Danny Thomas, Jerry Lewis, and Neil Diamond. It just gets worse and worse. It has always been a lousy movie, and yet the ending, when the rabbi reconciles with his entertainer son, always works. It worked for us, too. The day after it aired, editorials praised the show. The Fox switchboard was flooded with calls. One man said it moved him to contact his father for the first time in 25 years. It was then we realized that our fans truly cared about our characters, all of our characters, except Lenny. Seminal episode number two, Homer at the Bat. Homer at the Bat changed the tone, the casting, the very reality of the show. It also saved a young boy's life. Really? What more could you ask for? Homer getting into the National Baseball Hall of Fame? Yeah, that happened too. It began when Sam Simon called Al Jean and me into his office to pitch a new story. Sam would explain an episode the way Oliver Hardy would lay out a scheme to Stan Laurel, in tiny, sing-songy chunks with long pauses in between. He said, Mr. Burns is going to have a softball team, and he'll hire 9 ringers to play on it, and we'll get 9 professional ball players to play themselves. This was season 3 of the show, and the previous 17 episodes had covered baseball, mini golf, boxing, soapbox racing, and football. Now we were doing baseball again. As might be expected from a show written primarily by single men, The Simpsons was sports mad. For 3 months of every year, our office became a football pool that occasionally put out a TV show. We even had our own bookie. Everyone on our staff loved sports, except me. But I served a purpose. I represented everyone's wives and mothers in the audience. I'd be the lone voice saying, will everyone get this joke about Mordecai Three-Finger Brown? Yes, I was the staff girl. To this day, I don't understand the ending of this episode. Homer wins the big game by getting knocked out cold by a pitch. How? Why? Huh? What? So what? Virtually any other Simpsons writer could have done this script. Jeff Martin and John Vitti had both worked as sports writers. Al Jean would be the first person every year to buy the latest Bill James baseball abstract. By the following day, he had read and memorized the 1,000-page doorstop. But John Swartzwelder was our biggest baseball fan. He owns a huge amount of sports memorabilia, including what he claims is the first baseball, which I imagine is made of mastodon hide an autograph by Ruth. Not Babe, but the Babe from the Old Testament. We cast 9 real-life baseball players. Only Ricky Henderson and Ryne Sandberg turned us down. And Swartzwelder created quick, crazy stories for each of them. Ozzie Smith visits the Springfield mystery spot and plunges into a bottomless pit. Roger Clemens gets hypnotized and thinks he's a chicken. Wade Boggs gets into a fistfight over who was a better British prime minister, Lord Palmerston or Pitt the Elder. Ken Griffey Jr. overdoses on nerve tonic and gets gigantism. Is that even a thing? Jose Canseco does something nice for someone. This one really stretched credibility. Up to this point, The Simpsons had been praised for its authenticity. They're realer than most real families on TV, opined many a blowhard. But this episode didn't just stretch reality, it snapped it, hacked it to pieces, and left it to die in a drainage ditch. It was a very different Simpsons episode, including the fact that The Simpsons are barely in it. Here, the guest stars were running the asylum. Needless to say, our cast didn't like the show. Our table reading of the script bombed utterly. 2 of our actors complained about the script, the only time this has ever happened. The baseball players were much easier to deal with. Don Mattingly had only one gripe. His character makes his first appearance wearing an apron and washing dishes. "Do I have to do this?" he moaned. "I'm sorry, it's in the script. It can't be changed," Al Jean lied. "Okay," Mattingly grumbled. The players were surprisingly good actors. Mike Socha could be a real professional. In voice acting, you never know who's going to have the gift. When Aerosmith did our show, their bass player, Tom Hamilton, had great comic timing and a huge range of funny voices. And then there was Ken Griffey Jr. He got angry because he didn't understand his line, "There's a party in my mouth, and everyone's invited." If he had understood it, he would have been really angry. Adding to the pressure, his father, Ken Griffey Sr., was there, trying to coach him through the line, and it wasn't helping. The room was going to implode, so that's when they called in me, the staff girl. Since I didn't really know who Griffey was, they figured I wouldn't be intimidated by him. Al shoved me into the tiny recording booth. This instantly became my new worst fear, to be locked in a small glass booth with a large angry man. And I couldn't get out until I made him say a vaguely homoerotic line. It took a few takes, but we got the line. Decades later, Griffey appeared in a mockumentary about the episode. He's become a much better actor. Despite the misgivings of the cast, Homer at the Bat was a huge hit. It was the first time we beat our competition, The Cosby Show. We beat Cosby several more times after that. Within 2 years, his show was off the air. You're welcome. It's also the show that intoxicated us with guest stars and helped us realize we could get almost anyone we wanted. The next year, I insisted we do an all-star spectacular with celebrities I had heard of. It was Krusty Gets Canceled, and it featured Elizabeth Taylor, Johnny Carson, Bette Midler, and many, many more. Many more, but not Mandy Moore. I'm just not a fan. Homer at the Bat also stretched the reality of the show, and nobody minded. The series would get a little crazier after that. The next year, we'd have Leonard Nimoy beam out of a scene like Mr. Spock. There was no turning back. A quarter century has passed since Homer at the Bat debuted. Our bookie is long dead. We talk much less about sports and much more about tuition costs. Since 1992, our staff girl has been a real girl, the brilliant Carolyn Omine. But the episode is still remembered fondly. In May 2017, Homer was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Wade Boggs, Steve Sachs, and Ozzie Smith showed up at the ceremony. Smith said the number one question he gets asked is, "How did you escape from the Springfield mystery spot?" Boggs said he still sticks up for Pitt the Elder. Oh yeah, and before I forget, the show really did save a kid's life. The episode opens with Homer choking on a donut. His friends ignore a poster for the Heimlich maneuver to study the sign-up sheet for Mr. Burns' softball team. A week later, the Los Angeles News featured an 8-year-old boy who saved his friend from choking to death. When asked where he learned the Heimlich, he said, "It was on a poster on The Simpsons." True story. And the name of the boy whose life was saved? It was Ryan Gosling. That part's fake. I just needed an ending.